you just explain math to them?
Well, like we're too self-referential.
Is that how analytics work?
I think I did my math right.
I do not trust your math at all.
Technically correct.
And people call us smug.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, cold weather, Derek Carr. The Raiders offense is doomed. We will get to that around 10:30. We're also going to have Cassie Soto on here, not too long, to break down her concussion from the UNLV-Nevada fight. TJ Otzelberger got another moral victory. We'll get to some UNLV basketball later in the show. But rivalries are the greatest, at least when you win. Anyways, UNLV-Nevada was fantastic. During and after, we can add Steve Jenkins to the technically correct list of soon-to-be-forgotten heroes. UNLV football does not play in big-time games. They never play for any sort of championship or titles. They never play as a ranked team. They're never close to being ranked. They rarely even have five wins where, oh, their next win gets them to bowl eligibility. The only big game that UNLV plays every year is against Nevada. And no one remembers the guys that make the biggest plays when they beat Nevada. Since I've been in Vegas, UNLV's won the Cannon three times. The first member of our Forgotten Heroes is Ryan McAleenan, who had a pick six back in 2015. That was the biggest play of that game that helped UNLV win. Javen White is on this list because he had two interceptions last year, including the game-sealing one. You haven't forgotten Javen White yet because he's been the best player on the team this year.
Give it about
3 months and you will have no idea who Javen White is, and he will be on this list. And now Steve Jenkins, wide receiver, had five catches, 140 yards, two touchdowns, including the game-winning touchdown in overtime. And then he gave us the greatest celebration by waving goodbye to the Nevada sideline and sprinting the length of the field, taunting the Nevada sideline. It was wonderful. Steve Jenkins is a member of the Forgotten Heroes, or soon-to-be Forgotten Heroes. I will also not have our Forgotten Hero slandered by saying his taunting, his celebration, had anything to do with the fight. Him celebrating, no.
He was very far away from where the fight.
He was on the opposite side of the field of where the fight was.
He was still running around.
Nobody on Nevada's sideline stepped onto the field and punched him in the face. Like, that did not happen. Everyone on Nevada's sideline just sort of took it. They were like, oh, okay, yeah, that guy, he beat us. Like, everyone on the sideline just sort of took it. Like, that was perfectly fine. No one reacted to that. Fight was on the other side of the field. So, I will not have him slandered. Steve Jenkins is a hero. Steve Jenkins is a treasure. He scored two touchdowns in this game. The first one, he shushed the crowd, which was pretty good on its own. But to wave goodbye after catching the game-winning touchdown and then sprint down the sideline, taunting them the whole way, beautiful job by Steve Jenkins. Couldn't love that anymore. Now, the fight itself actually happened because Austin Arnold, a defensive back for Nevada, sucker-punched Kenyon Oblad. Like, came up behind him, punched him right in the head. And then it looked like it was an offensive lineman for UNLV that came and lit up Austin Arnold after that, and that's when the fight broke out. Wasn't there. We'll talk to Cassie Soto, who was there, in a little bit, see if we have any more details from her. But from what we've seen, from the information that we do have on this fight, to me, there's not a whole lot of issues. Like, I think there's only a few things we can really point to. The first one being Austin Arnold's sucker punch on Kenyon Oblad. That's a pretty cheap move. You run up behind the guy and punch him in the face. The second thing is Giovanni Faolo. So we don't have any video evidence of Giovanni Faolo swinging his helmet at fans, but Nevada Sportsnet reported that he swung his helmet at fans. There is a picture from Getty Images of him holding the helmet above his head while looking at the crowd. It looks like he could be swinging his helmet, but again, it's a still photo. And then we have Caleb Herring on Twitter saying, yes, it was bad. Didn't really confirm anything, but just said, yes, this was bad by Giovanni Faolo. So again, we don't really have video evidence. If somebody threw a cup at his face and then he swung his helmet back, I guess maybe you could give him the benefit of the doubt there. But it appears as though Giovanni Faolo swung his helmet at the crowd. That's a very bad thing to do, regardless of what was happening before that. So we have Austin Arnold's sucker punch, Giovanni Faolo swinging his helmet. Outside of that, I haven't seen a whole lot from the player side that I really have an issue with, because once the fight breaks out and it's all retaliation, I don't really care too much. I mean, I guess if somebody fell on the ground and you're stomping on his face, like there's things that could have happened. But from what we've seen, Noah Bean threw a guy up against a fence. Like it seemed might have been a little excessive, but still.
I mean, as long as you don't use your helmet as a weapon and like throw it down on the other team's quarterback, I think that it's fine.
Pretty good.
Right?
So like, again, it's not necessarily like you want to see it, but I don't have a big issue with it. The other part that maybe is the biggest problem in this whole thing is the Nevada crowd, because when this happens, you have Nevada fans throwing things onto the field. One of them hits Cassie Soto in the head. You have Nevada fans ripping off Jackson Reynolds' helmet, one of UNLV's offensive linemen, and you have Nevada fans pulling at another UNLV player's helmet and his hair. Like, that's the other part of this that I think is fairly ridiculous, because you just can't have the crowd getting involved in what's happening on the field, regardless of what's actually happening on the field. You can't have that happen, because it's if you go back like 16 years to the Malice at the Palace, when Ron Artest and Ben Wallace started shoving each other, the whole reason that turned into the Malice at the Palace is because a fan threw something at Ron Artest.
Yeah.
Like, it was originally just the players pushing and shoving each other, and if nobody throws anything from the crowd, that situation probably de-escalates by itself.
I mean,
and there's no
point,
big issue.
Ron Artest is laying on the scores.
That's when he got hit by a cup.
Yeah, no, but he's just like, all right, we're done.
Yeah.
He's laying on the scores table, gets hit by a cup, and it's like, uh-oh.
So that's kind of what this felt like to me, where you have an on-field, on-court fight happening, but you're like, all right, it's the players, it's whatever. But then as soon as the crowd gets involved, you're like, okay. And like, this one didn't escalate to that point where there were either fans on the field or players in the crowd where it gets really bad. But that's sort of how that Malice in the Palace happened. So that's part of it. Now, for me, I hope there's not an overreaction to this. Punish Austin Arnold. Sure. Punish Giovanni Faolo. Sure. If you have any other video evidence of guys taking cheap shots or swinging helmets or stomping on people, whatever, punish those players. Absolutely. If you can identify the fans, punish them. Be prepared for fights in the future. If you listen to the press box this morning, they had Steve Cofield on, and both Steve and Ed were ripping Nevada for not having enough security ready to go because the game's ending and there might be a fight. Sure, be more prepared for fights, but I don't think there's a whole lot to react to on this. Like, punish the individual players. If you can punish individual fans, sure, but this is a rivalry. Like, this is what's kind of supposed to happen. Like, this is what, like, here's the thing with UNLV football. The biggest problem for UNLV athletics is apathy. Fans do not care about UNLV sports right now. And based on the crowd that was at that game, fans might not be caring about Nevada sports either in Reno right now. So apathy is the biggest problem. There is no apathy in this game. This is the one time a year where people are like, oh, yes, I want UNLV to win. This is the one time a year where people are living and dying on every play for UNLV football and not just mocking the program. Don't try to get rid of that. Don't try to neuter the rivalry in the future. Like, this is kind of a good thing. Like, punish the people that went over the top. But, like, pushing and shoving each other on the field, it's kind of a good thing.
Yeah. I don't have any other argument.
Like,
you're 100% right.
Like, Steve Jenkins running down the sideline taunting them? Excellent. Give me more of that. All of the time. The entire game, that's what I want. Yes. People cross the line. Yes, there is a line. You can come out and establish there's a line. But I just hate the fact that the athletic directors put out a statement together and were like, oh, we condone. Like, no, yeah, we know you condone it, but it's actually good. Like, it's actually a good thing for you for this rivalry. It's good that there is some hatred. Let the hatred live. It's the best part of UNLV football is this game and the fact that there is actually a team that you hate and a team that you want to beat that badly. Jared, you lost Cassie? Jared's over here trying to get Cassie. He's talking to her, and then all of a sudden, he's got to hang up the phone. I don't even know what happened over there. So Cassie Soto, if you're unaware, works for the Review Journal, videographer. She got hit in the head with a bottle of some sort thrown from the crowd, and Cassie Soto was in the middle of the fight. Cassie joins us now. All right, Cassie, how'd you get hit in the head? How is your head feeling?
I feel great. No concussion signs, though I don't think I've ever had a concussion, but I feel great this morning. I got hit in the head by, it had to have been like a Mountain Dew, which is ironic because I love Mountain Dew. Mountain Dew soda bottle came launching from the crowd, and it hit me when there was like that scrum up against where the fans were. That's what I was trying to get video of, so I was kind of off to the side. So the left side of my head was facing the crowd, so in perfect target range to get hit in the head, and that's what happened.
Have you considered that they were just maybe trying to give you a Mountain Dew because they knew you liked it?
I mean, early Christmas present? I don't know.
Did you see anything in the fight that was, like, over the top that we haven't been able to see on video yet?
No, I've been looking back at the video since I got home. So, obviously, I have, like, the tail end of Kenyon Oblad falling to the ground. And that's what caught my attention, that I knew something bad was about to happen. And then when the two players went over to the zonies, I think that's what they're called, right? Nevada's number, let me see, I think I'm looking at the video now, 96 and UNLV's 11, because they fell into the snow and then other players were kicking them. Like, when they were down on the floor, they were, like, stomping on them. So that's what caught my attention, like, to run that way. And that's when I got hit. So I got, like, a close-up of that. So that's, I think, from, like, the high angle of the cameras you probably weren't able to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we do have stomping of players on the ground.
Yeah, yeah. They were kicking. I'm looking at it right now. They were, like, kicking at the guys on the ground. They were in the snow.
Because for the most part, like, I don't think there's too big of an issue with guys pushing and shoving each other. But sucker punching a guy, swinging your helmet, and stomping on people, that would seem to be the three biggest issues from this fight of people going over the line.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. And then, like, I'm looking at now, here comes both coaches come running in. Like, I was just trying to get some guys celebrating, and next thing I know, I'm recording a huge freaking fight.
Now, the fight is obviously the big story here, but we would be failing the show if we did not ask you about the pregame proposal by Nevada's punter.
Which,
oh, God, it was
think,
a punter?
Do we think he's still getting, like, married after this? Like,
well, see, and
my
Cassie,
goodness.
This is why it's a terrible idea. This is not the only reason why, but this is why it is a terrible idea. He got proposed on the day that his team, A, lost the biggest game of their season, and B, got in a fight.
Like, how bad is that? I don't think I've ever been to, like, seen, like, a proposal gone wrong this way, where, like, the guy who proposes just failed miserably.
Well, yeah,
in
he
winning
was no
game,
good either.
So.
Yeah. And he was no good on his first punt. It's like a 24-yard punt or something like that. See, he ruined it, Cassie. His proposal story is terrible.
He
now.
Jinxed himself. He did this. Kenyon Oblad didn't do this. He did this.
Who say yes to the punter?
What do you mean? Punters
he's
make money.
He's got really nice hair. He's got some luscious locks.
Oh,
so
Jesus.
He's got that going for
I think
him.
He'd have to. He's the punter.
All right, we have one other event you need to take us through that was actually caught on camera by AT&T Sportsnet. You tripping on the sideline. What happened?
Okay, so I actually posted on my Twitter not that long ago my angle. And in my viewfinder, so what I'm looking at, they look like they were right in front of me. So I went to take a step back, but the freaking Aquafina ad, sideline ad banner was in my way, and I fell into that. So as I was trying to back up, I tripped and ate it. And my ex-co-workers at the Mountain West said, "Did you just fall on the sidelines?" And 2 seconds later, I get a clip of it. So
I need to be paying more attention to the sidelines during games, apparently.
This is the first time it's ever happened. And I freaking jinxed myself because I thought on the car ride there, like, man, I've gone a whole football season without getting injured. So something was just bound to happen.
And then
that
you tripped over an advertisement for a bottle of water, and then you were hit in the head with an actual bottle of soda.
Everyone just thought you were thirsty.
I guess.
I mean, they've seen her tweets about getting proposed to. They know she's thirsty.
Oh.
Thanks, Cassie.
Low. Thanks, guys.
So she is Cassie Soto from the Review Journal. You can follow her at Cassie at underscore Cassie Soto on Twitter. Yeah, so there you go. There's Cassie Soto. I got one thing left on the UNLV football game that we need to go over. It doesn't really matter because Tony Sanchez is no longer the coach, so actually what happens in the game doesn't matter. But the best part of the passing game, Kenyon Oblad was excellent. It was by far his best game of the season. You've had 2 years in a row where UNLV's quarterback has their best game of the season against Nevada. But the best part of the actual football game, the best part of Kenyon Oblad in the passing game, was UNLV actually had a wide receiver run a double move. They did it twice in this game, but the game-winning touchdown to Steve Jenkins is a double move. I should have been yelling about this all season because UNLV's passing game just has been begging for double moves. Because what they do, they have their receivers run 5 to 10 yards down the field. If it's zone, they just have them sit down in a little curl route somewhere in the zone. If it's man, they run an in or an out, trying to get open. That's all they do. The entire passing game is built around those two concepts. It's begging for a double move because those are easy routes to jump, and all you have to do is fake it and then run behind the safety. That's exactly what Steve Jenkins did on the final play, and it worked for a wide-open touchdown. And they did it twice in the game where they ran a double move and had a wide receiver wide open. I don't know. Tony Sanchez was waiting until the last game of his tenure to bust it out, but he finally did, and it was awesome.
Well, maybe he just... I mean, there's got to be some, like, F it. Let's just go ahead and try that thing that we haven't been able to get done in practice.
Maybe, yeah. It doesn't work in practice. Like, we're never going to run this in a game.
Well, it's also, it's his last game. It's just like, all right,
perfect.
Sure.
It was so perfect. They should have been doing it for 5 years. Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Make sure you place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long, every Monday night. Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It is Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from beconnectedsports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at beconnectedsports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Kim DeRutter's agent toured the Fertitta football complex.
Mark Anderson of the Review Journal tweeted, the agents for Cal defensive coordinator and former Fresno State head coach Tim DeRutter recently toured the Fertitta football complex and were very impressed. They say DeRutter is heavily interested in the UNLV opening. They also represent Raiders coach John Gruden.
So that doesn't completely get rid of Jay.
If you fire Sanchez for Tim DeRutter, I don't know. DeRutter was at Fresno State as the head coach. He took over a 4-win team. The next year, they went 9-4. They went 11-2 in his second season. He won back-to-back Mountain West titles. Year three, they lost in the Mountain West title game, only at a 6-8 record because they lost the Mountain West title game and their bowl game. Then he went 3-9 and then was fired in season after a 1-7 start. So, fell off a cliff very quickly at Fresno State. His recruiting rankings at Fresno State weren't bad, but also weren't great. He was basically like fourth or fifth almost every year in the Mountain West while recruiting to Fresno State. So if you just look at that head coaching track record, it's better than Tony Sanchez, but it's not great. Like, it's nothing to really be excited about. He's been at Cal as the defensive coordinator for the last 3 years. The last two, Cal has actually been top four in the Pac-12 in both scoring defense and total defense. So he's done a pretty good job with Cal's defense over the last couple of years. I don't know that firing Sanchez and hiring Tim DeRutter is the right answer. Like, I'm not 100% convinced. I would say Tim DeRutter, probably a better college football coach than Tony Sanchez, but not significantly better. Like, I don't think there's that much of an advantage to getting Tim DeRutter in here over Tony Sanchez. So if you make the move to fire Sanchez and you bring in DeRutter, okay, it's kind of like, all right, what do you really like about Tim DeRutter to make him the guy for the job?
Cody Eakin is week to week with an upper body injury.
That is according to Gerard Gallant. Eakin left Friday's game after getting hit in the head. Dave Shane tweeted out their line rushes from practice yesterday. The first line intact, the second line intact, the third line is apparently going to be Will Carrier, Cody Glass, and Alex Tuck. Cody Glass was possibly on his way out of the lineup during that game on Friday. He got moved down in-game to basically the fourth line, but Eakin got hurt. And now there's just a hole as for third-line center, and that's where Cody Glass can step in. And if you're Cody Glass, you absolutely have to take the job. Like, I don't know how long Cody Eakin's going to be out for. Week to week means absolutely nothing. At least means a week. So you're at least going to get three games this week in New York to play as the third line center. Cody Glass has to take that job. A, it shouldn't be that hard to take that job. Cody Eakin's been one of the worst forwards in the NHL this year. So just being average makes you unbelievably better than Cody Eakin. So, but Glass has to take it. Like, he absolutely, A, he was a top 10 pick a couple of years ago. You would hope he can be better than Cody Eakin. Even in his rookie season, you hope a top 10 pick is better than Cody Eakin. So for the long-term hope of Cody Glass being good, you hope he steals this job away due to Cody Eakin's injury. But also, for the short term of this team being good, they need something better than Cody Eakin as their third-line center. Cody Glass is the obvious answer to that if he can be a good third-line center, but we've got to see that. And can he do it with Will Carrier and Alex Tuch instead of doing it with Max Pacioretty and Mark Stone? That's really a big question, because we haven't seen Cody Glass have much success unless he's playing with Mark Stone. Whether it's on the power play or 5-on-5, that's pretty much the only time he's had genuine success. So can you do it with Will Carrier and Alex Tuch or whoever else they rotate in there at third line winger? That's the big question for Cody Glass.
The Raiders may force UNLV to play two more games at Sam Boyd Stadium.
Oh, boy. All right. So on Wednesday's show before Thanksgiving, we talked about this. Steve Cofield last week had talked to people that said UNLV were worried about having to play games at Sam Boyd Stadium next year. The two reasons Cofield cited, one was the stadium opening date possibly being delayed, so UNLV might miss their season opener. The other issue was contracts with Arizona State and Louisiana Tech, who might not be happy about playing at Raider Stadium. But what the RJ is reporting is that the Raiders would be the ones forcing UNLV out, potentially. Mark Anderson said that the Raiders don't really want UNLV playing three home games in the stadium before the Raiders play their first home game, because they want their first home game to be a spectacle, and they think UNLV playing a bunch of games there before them will somehow ruin that spectacle. Which is the most ridiculous premise I've ever heard in my life.
Do they need pictures of Sam Boyd Stadium stands?
Exactly. There's no way that a UNLV football game somehow takes the shine off of the Raiders' first home regular season game in Allegiant Stadium. There's no way. There's nothing UNLV football can do. Like, I guess they could get in a fight with Nevada, maybe. But, like, there's nothing UNLV football can do.
I would not want to get into a fight with Arizona State.
There's nothing UNLV football can do that's going to somehow diminish the first Raiders game at that stadium.
If anything, it's like a soft opening. Like, you're going to figure out, like...
Oh, that didn't work. All right, we got to fix this.
Yeah, like, hey, all the soda machines broke. We got to get that fixed before the Raiders play here.
Here's the issue for the Raiders. I'm not sure they can actually do this. They have the agreement they have with UNLV. They have approval denial power over UNLV's schedule. And UNLV basically has to come to them and say, hey, this is when we want to play home games. And the Raiders say, all right, these ones work, these ones don't work, try again. Right? They have approval or denial. But once they approve UNLV's schedule, the only way they can force UNLV to move a game is if there's an NFL event that overlaps with it.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. They can force them. If for whatever reason UNLV has a game and the Raiders are like, oh, we've got to move a game to Saturday or something like that, like, they can force UNLV out for that reason, but no other reason can they force UNLV out. So if they've already approved, and I don't know what the exact process of approving their schedule is, but if they've already approved UNLV's schedule or okayed it for this season or next season, they can't just go back and say, hey, we want to kick you out just because.
He's such a bad look.
Now, again, maybe they haven't approved it. That seems to be the potential issue here, but that is. Again, this is all sort of speculation, so we don't actually know if this is going to happen, but to me, the Raiders might end up not kicking UNLV out. UNLV might end up playing all of their games next year at Allegiant Stadium, and this is no problem. But just the fact that it's the December before Allegiant Stadium opens, and we're already having like some issue of the Raiders just simply don't want UNLV to play there, it's terrible sign for UNLV's long-term future at the stadium. Terrible sign for UNLV's long-term health at the stadium. The Raiders are going to take anything they possibly can, and thanks to A, the Senate bill that was passed by the Nevada State Legislature, and B, the joint use agreement that they have with UNLV, they can pretty much take whatever they want. They kind of have control of everything. Like, even UNLV's revenue from game days at the new stadium, the stadium company, which is de facto the Raiders, they get all the money and then give it to UNLV. So they can get all the money and say, okay, you actually owe us this much, and give UNLV nothing. They could do that. Like, they control it. So UNLV's totally screwed at the stadium.
I would like the instant karma of they force UNLV not to play these two games, and then the opening, the grand spectacle of opening Raiders Stadium is sort of like when the Cubs went to open Wrigley too early, and there's just people standing in line for the bathroom, and there's cups of urine everywhere because they were like, maybe we should have waited another week.
I mean, I would venture to guess there's a good chance the stadium's not fully completed when they actually open it on July 31st. Like, a lot of things open without being fully completed. I know just the Fertitta Football Complex was quote-unquote opened before it was, and they weren't even close. They were like 40% done. But like, a lot of things are going to open before it's fully completed. It's just a question of what's not fully completed. You'd hope the bathrooms are fully completed if you're planning on having 65,000 people there for a Raiders game. That's going to be pretty terrible if they don't. But there'll be some things that probably aren't done. I think T-Mobile opened and it wasn't fully completed when they had their first events there. So there'll be something that's not done. You just hope it's like a random locker room or something that nobody has to use on game day, and not, oh, we only have one bathroom open. Coming up next, does John Gruden have to move on from Derek Carr after another embarrassing loss for the Raiders?
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Technically Correct.
Still got about 20% get in. I got to get rid of. You understand?
With Tyler Bischoff.
Struck by lightning. Sounds pretty frightening. Was that the end of Derek Carr? At least in playing important games for the Raiders. That was about as big of a game as you can play if you're the Raiders. A win, and you're leading the AFC West with 4 weeks to play in the season. Derek Carr goes in, and prior to his garbage time touchdown in the final minutes of the fourth quarter, he was 12 of 21 for 152 yards and two picks. The Raiders scored 9 points. They did not score a single point until it was 31-0. They kicked a field goal down 31-0, by the way, and cut a four-possession game down to a four-possession game. If we do what is probably bad analysis and measure quarterbacks in big games, Carr hasn't played in many as the Raiders quarterback. They haven't played many big games as a team, so he doesn't get to be the quarterback in many big games. This was at least the biggest of the John Gruden, Derek Carr era, and he was awful. Like, the Raiders had no chance, and it's largely because of Derek Carr. He throws a pick on the first drive to give Kansas City points, and then he throws a pick six that basically ends the game in the second quarter when the Chiefs went up 21-0. My favorite play of the game actually came when the game was already over, but Josh Jacobs was doing jumping jacks because he was wide open for a check down, and Derek Carr... To be fair, Jacobs is on the opposite side of the field where all of the other receivers ran, so there's no real reason for Carr to go to that side of the field. But Josh Jacobs was wide open and for like 5 seconds, and Derek Carr didn't see him and ended up taking a sack.
Okay, but also, when he was running backwards trying to avoid the sack, he was facing...
That's a good point. That's a good
Josh
point.
Josh Jacobs. If he was smart, he would have just tried a flip pass.
That's a good point. Somehow we've evolved to a point where we're criticizing Derek Carr for not throwing a check down.
Well, he's not going to do the other thing.
But that game was basically for the season. Now the Raiders, I mean, they can still make the playoffs, but the AFC West is done. Like, they're three back. They've got to make up 3 games in the Chiefs over the last 4 games of the season. The wild card's possible, but they actually have to play extremely well. They might need to win all 4. Like, they certainly need to win 3 of the last 4. But that was the biggest game, and Carr was the biggest reason you'd point to for the Raiders losing. Listen, the defense, the Chiefs came into that game 2nd in the NFL in yards per play at 6.5. They held them to 4.5 yards per play in that game. Like, the Chiefs put up a lot of points, but they had a pick six. They had a short field because of another Derek Carr interception. And there were some penalties that sort of factor into the yardage there. But the defense actually did a pretty solid job on keeping the Chiefs in check. I think it was one play of over 20 yards. The Chiefs came in most plays over 20 yards. The defense was fine. The two Carr interceptions basically gave him 14 points. Josh Jacobs ran through the Chiefs 17 for 104. The only real problem in that game was the passing game was worthless. That's why they lost the game. And so long term, what do you do with Derek Carr? He cost you more than $20 million against the salary cap. He is a big hit to your salary cap. Does John Gruden think he can make the playoffs with Derek Carr as his quarterback? Does he think he can win in the playoffs with Derek Carr as his quarterback? Does he think he can do better than Derek Carr? Or at least the same with a significantly lower cap hit? Because I think, yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think you can, A, win with Derek Carr. Everything else around him has to be good. But I also think you can get about 90% of Carr's production from a quarterback that's costing you, what, 50% of what Carr's costing you right now? Like, and when you need to build a roster that's really good so your quarterback can succeed, it's much easier to do that when you're paying your quarterback $10 million or less instead of $20 or $25 million like Derek Carr is getting. But here's the problem for Carr when you're sort of evaluating this season. Raiders have had a top five offensive line all year. Josh Jacobs has been a top 10, maybe top five running back all year. The only real problem with the offense is the wide receivers. They don't have good wide receivers. Like, it's Tyrell Williams and Zay Jones. That's the only real problem. But Derek Carr is having his best statistical season. This is the best Derek Carr has been. This is peak Derek Carr. And I'm not sure that Gruden's going to ditch peak Derek Carr. But the problem is you have peak Derek Carr and you're 6-6. You have peak Derek Carr and the Raiders are outside the top 20 in points scored in the NFL this year. You have peak Derek Carr and an excellent running game. And the Raiders are outside the top 20 in points scored. That doesn't work. Like, you cannot be as good as they are running the ball. You cannot have as good of an offensive line as they have and be outside the top 20 in points with your quarterback having his best season ever. It's not like they've got Joe Flacco or Phillip Rivers having a terrible season. Right, Derek Carr's having his best season ever, and they're still outside the top 20 in points. That should be enough to move on.
How much are you buying into the post-game comment of he's a good quarterback, he's got a chance to be great, just wasn't his day?
Not a whole lot. I think John Gruden says he has a lot of quotes like that about players that don't really mean a whole lot. Like, yeah, if you ask him about any player on his roster, he'll give you some sort of quote like that. And that was just sort of after a game. Gruden doesn't want to pile on his quarterback, right? Like,
okay,
his quarterback wasn't good. I'm sure John Gruden absolutely knows that Derek Carr is going to get piled on for that game. He doesn't want to add to it. He doesn't want to add, well, we got to look at Mike Glennon. Like, he doesn't want to do anything like that. So I don't read a whole lot into that as far as the long-term future. I think that's just what John Gruden would do if you asked him about any player that struggled in that game. Like, maybe there would be some rookie defensive back that he might light up and say, we got to do better. But for the most part, I think that's what he's saying about any of his higher profile players. So not a whole lot. Now, if you do move on from Carr, after this season, you can release him or trade him, and the cap hit or the dead cap hits $5 million. So you'd end up saving $16.5 million against the cap for next season. And then in 2021 and 2022, you're completely off the hook. There's no carryover for those last 2 years of his contract. So you can save a significant amount. What can you do? Can you get a better quarterback next year with $16.5 million? Like, how much did Nick Foles sign for? 20-something million?
Yeah.
Like, so maybe not. You might not be able to unless you go rookie and you draft one and you actually think you found a good one. My one question, though, is really I don't know that John Gruden's going to be as cutthroat with Derek Carr. Like, A, Carr's been good overall this season. Like, he hasn't been good the last few weeks, but the entirety of the season, Carr's been good. I don't know that John Gruden sees losses as Derek Carr's fault. And more importantly,
they held Patrick Mahomes to 14 points.
More importantly, the Raiders are 6-6. And they should probably win at least two more games. Jags and Titans at home, Chargers and Broncos on the road. Like, they're probably going to be 8-8 at the end of the year. An 8-8 Raiders team is the second best record this franchise has had in 16 years. John Gruden absolutely sees this as a rebuilding project. So going from 4 wins in your first year to 8 wins in your second year, even when you miss the playoffs. Well, yeah, that too. But you're absolutely going to see that as a success if you're John Gruden. And I think the way Gruden's going to see it, when I say peak, this is peak Derek Carr, I think the way Gruden's going to see it is I can make the peak for Derek Carr even higher. Rather than this is the highest Derek Carr can go, we got the most out of him. So I think John Gruden, I think that's the way he's going to see it as, hey, we improved quite a bit from year one to year two. My quarterback was good. I can make, like he said, I can make him great. So I kind of think that's what he's going to do. And listen, that might work out as far as making the playoffs because the Raiders, they have $20 million in cap space right now. Like, they absolutely could have Khalil Mack on this team right now or Antonio Brown. Like, they have plenty of cap space right now. They've got, I think, over-projected $60, $70 million for next year. They have a ton of cap space to improve the roster, even with Carr on the books. So I think John Gruden, that would be my guess, that he looks at it and says, well, I can make Carr better. We improved a lot. And I don't need the extra $16.5 million in cap space because I've got $60 or $70 million to spend. So let's go. We're going to spend it, and we're going to keep Derek Carr.
Okay, so Teddy Bridgewater is going to be available, right?
Is he? I don't know. What's his contract status? Is he a free agent?
I believe he is.
Okay.
I believe he's a free agent at the end of this year. Eli Manning.
Oh, good God.
Is going to be available.
No.
If a guy named Devlin keeps playing as well, Ben Roethlisberger will be available. Like, what middling level quarterback?
But my question is, how much do you have to pay those guys? Because again, Nick Foles got $20 million.
I think Eli and Ben, you're paying for, like, let's throw on a pair of shorts. Let's see if you still got anything left.
The problem with going after, I would be a much bigger fan of drafting a quarterback. They're cheaper, significantly cheaper, and if you go get, let's just say, Ben Roethlisberger, and you have to pay him $15 million, that's not that much less than Derek Carr. Like, you're not saving a significant amount. And when you throw in Derek Carr's dead cap hit, it actually ends up being the same for next year. So,
okay, well, what about a Gardner Minshew or a Will
Gardner Minshew? He's going to make $32 million next year. What are you talking about? He's going to make so much money? Yeah, I mean, you're right. Conceive, like, if you could give me Gardner Minshew, actually, he's on a rookie contract, but if you could give
That's
me Gardner
what I mean.
Minshew for whatever he's making, $2 million, $4 million, absolutely, you'd rather have Gardner Minshew at $4 million than Derek Carr at 21, but I don't know how many quarterbacks you can go find and you only pay them $4 million that are actually, you know, an average NFL quarterback.
I thought the whole rule is you just find someone named Allen, and
was
they'll give you, like, 2 weeks, and so you just hire all the Allens.
I should have drafted that one Josh Allen this year. Defense might be a whole lot better.
Why didn't they run the ball?
They did on 4th-and-1. They gave it to Trevor Davis on an end-around.
I just, like... No, but you're... The Chiefs' defense is historically bad at stopping the run.
Yeah, and I mean, they ran the ball a little bit early, but... I wouldn't put too much into it. Josh Jacobs had, what?
17 carries?
I think it was 14 in the first half, which is a lot, and then 3 in the second half because you're down 3 scores, so you're not... I don't know. You probably still... It's probably UNLV football. You probably should still run the ball because that's the best way to do it, but yeah, I don't blame them too much for that. Coming up, why is T.J. Altzelberger's offense at UNLV broken?
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
Eli inbound, baseline left side. Bounces to Hardy on the left wing. Amari brings it out top. Amari back to Eli with 15 seconds to go. Eli's going to drive, loses the ball, gets it back. Right side to Tillman. Tillman in the corner. He'll shoot a three. That's an air ball. Hamilton tips the basketball to Donnie Tillman. Out to Eli. Open for a three. It's good! And we're tied with a second to go. Cumberland can't get a shot off, and the Rebels go to overtime.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
Too bad T.J. Altzelberger swore off moral victories because they got another one. Overtime loss at Cincinnati. That is a moral victory. And to go full-blown moral victory, there are only two Mountain West teams ranked higher in KenPom than Cincinnati. So if UNLV can take Cincinnati to overtime on the road, they can beat anyone in the Mountain West. They held Cincinnati to 0.9 points per possession. The only team this year to hold Cincinnati to a lower points per possession is Ohio State, who is currently top five in KenPom. UNLV held Cincinnati's best player, Jerron Cumberland, to 3 of 12 shooting, by far his worst offensive night of the year. UNLV erased a 10-point deficit in the final 70 seconds of that game. Winning time, or as somebody on Twitter corrected me, tying time. They did not actually win the game. It was tying time. And UNLV actually made a shot in the final seconds of a close game. First time in the Altsberger era they've made a shot when trailing by one possession or tied in the final 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, they missed a shot.
One, two.
Two. Yeah, I think you're right, two.
I have to go back and check. That's okay. We're taking it. That's the first one. We're off. We're
so
off 0%.
What they needed in the final seconds is three opportunities.
Yes. Yes. They actually got that with Marvin Menzies at New Mexico 2 years ago and missed all three of them. So sometimes, yeah, you don't make any of them. In a vacuum, that result is perfectly fine for a UNLV team without expectations, losing to Cincinnati, a team that's top 50 in KenPom, on the road in overtime. It's perfectly fine. There's no real issues with that loss. The problem is we're not in a vacuum, and UNLV is now 3-6 on the season. They're projected to lose their next two games, might very easily be 3-8. And even if they lose the next two in overtime, 3-8's not good. And we're at a point, it's still early in the season, but we're 9 games in, and barring UNLV getting a win away from home against Fresno State or BYU, they're going to be 3-8 with their best win coming over Purdue Fort Wayne. And again, the season doesn't have NCAA tournament meaning, but at some point they've got to beat somebody. Like you can't lose every game in overtime and still be a success. You've got to win against somebody. Because like right now, they've played 3 top 100 KenPom teams. They lost in overtime to Kansas State. They lost by 4 to SMU, and they lost in overtime to Cincinnati. It's good that UNLV is competitive. Like, that's a good sign for the rest of this season and into the future with Altsberger, because this year's team shouldn't be very good. But win one. Like, just finish with more points than the other team for once. Like, that's all you have to do. So we can't, like, because we can sit here and say they're 7 points away from being 6-3 with 3 top 100 wins. Right? That's very, and hell, throw in one more point against Cal and they're, what, 7-2. Right? 8 points away from being 7-2 with wins over Cal, Kansas State, SMU, and Cincinnati. That would be the most unbelievable start. People would be all over TJ Altsberger as some sort of savior. But they've lost all of those games. And you'd just like to see them win one or two. Like, win a close game here or there against a pretty good team. That's what we want to see. Now, the big negative from that game, UNLV's offense was a nightmare. 0.82 points per possession. Only their loss to Kansas State was worse. UNLV shot 32% from the floor in that game. Amori Hardy, 4 of 17 from 3, 0 of 7 on two-pointers. Tillman was 0 of 5 in that game. Top two scorers on the team combined to shoot 4 of 29. That's incredibly bad.
Scheibel hit a 3.
He did. Scheibel. Did hit a 3. Yeah, we got to get it down. It's Scheibel.
Oh. Okay.
UNLV is a team. 9 of 26 on layups. 35% on layups. That is unspeakably bad. To be 35% on layups. It comes down to length on defense and good defense. Like, UNLV is going to struggle with it all season. Cincinnati is 28th. As far as tallest teams in the country. But Amori Hardy is the perfect example for why this is a problem for UNLV. Cincinnati put a 6'5 guy on Amori Hardy, and Hardy just couldn't beat him off the dribble. Just couldn't do it. So Hardy had to take 17 threes in this game. Hardy was not good and had to take 17 threes. He only got 6 layup attempts in this game. Hardy's best skill is getting to the rim, and he could not do it. Anytime Hardy's taking more threes or 3 times as many threes as layups, it's very bad news for the offense. And Hardy sort of is a representation of the whole team, because Elijah Mitrelong was really the only player to have any success driving in this game. He was 3 of 9 on layups. Like, the only guy that got to the rim with any sort of consistency was Elijah Mitrelong, and he shot 33% on layups. Like, he couldn't finish when he got there. Ultimately, Cincinnati mostly shut down UNLV's offensive plays, like their offensive actions, and it leads to, hey, we got to give it to Hardy, give him a high ball screen with 8 seconds on the shot clock. But when the offense doesn't work and no one can win a one-on-one matchup, that's what you're going to get. Altsberger probably could have called a few more post-ups. He tried one for Tillman in the second half. Tillman turned it over. But that's one way you can generate some more paint touches when nobody can actually get it driving to the basket. post-ups aren't ideal, but neither is anything else UNLV did that day. So length is going to be a problem all year for UNLV. What they have to figure out is they scored 0.8 points per possession in that game. That's terrible. That's awful. Like, when you have a bad offensive night, it needs to be 0.9 points per possession. Like, you've got to be a little bit more efficient. Because if you're just a little bit more efficient in this game, you win.
Defense
Same with
good.
Kansas State. The defense has been good. Score.
There are no rules.